Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
See the dwarfs and see the giants. Which one would you choose to be? And if you can't get that together, here's the answer, here's the key. You can freeze like a 30-century man, like a 30-century man.
Do you prefer Stephen or Steve?
Stephen.
Stephen, yeah. Cool. If you want to get in nice and close, it'll...
Kayak. People always...
That's actually how it's pronounced. That's
yeah.
Great. Love it. So what's your background beyond just filmmaking? I mean, obviously you're American.
I'm a...
Where were you born and raised?
I'm a masshole, from Massachusetts. we're originally from near New Bedford, South Shore. Moved to a little town on Cape Cod, Massachusetts in the late 70s. You know, public high school, marching band, edited the school newspaper, wrote record reviews, worked in a record store, played drums in a band, a very awful cover band.
What did you cover? What songs?
My God. Well, we had a girl singer, so we knew the entire first Go-Go's album.
Amazing. We got the beat.
Yes. Skid Marks on My Heart, I think, was our favorite. We also had a dude who sang and played guitar, and he made us play things like old-time rock and roll and Message in a Bottle by the Police. We're, you know, kind
so
of
So did you kind of
crappy...
come of age in the punk new wave sort of era? Was that your
I did. That
time?
Was, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm a child of the 80s for sure. And I tried so hard to make our band cooler than it was, but I failed. I was only the drummer, right? I mean, but as we've seen, drummers can be quite powerful.
Amen.
I wasn't quite a Yoshiki back then. I couldn't even get them to play like one Susie and the Banshees song. Yeah, we were stuck with like the Police. No disrespect to the Police, but you know, the Police, Go-Go's. I think we had like we tried to play a Rush song. That's very
wow,
hard.
How'd you get on with that?
It's very hard on a drummer. It did not go well.
The last time I was actually around this area, there's a hotel just down the road a bit, was to interview Geddy Lee. Really nice man.
Oh,
really nice man.
He's a very nice man. I actually interviewed him briefly for a film I was involved with about Jaco Pastorius.
Robert Trujillo,
player.
I know kind of a little bit. I know the Mass Mental Project very well because Whitfield Crane and Benji Webb are good friends of mine. So
oh, no kidding.
I DJed the after party for their London show,
oh, really?
Which was amazing because it had the guy from Level 42.
Oh, wow.
Phil Campbell came
yes,
out.
Yes, he's really, they're
Armon,
really good friends.
The most insane.
Armon Sabaleka,
one of the most insane
incredible.
Bass players ever. So you directed the Jaco film with Robert as
I
a
somewhat
executive producer.
Directed it. We, my producer and I, we took it as far as we could. Let's just leave it at that. And then it was finished later. And yeah, let's just leave it at that.
Right.
But I love Jaco Pastorius. I think he's an absolute genius. You know, incredible spirit, amazing musician, and Why were we talking about Jaco? Sorry, just flew in. I'm completely jet lagged.
Well, I was with Robert on March the 11th, 2014, which is my birthday. That's why I remember the date. And he just received then and there like a final cut. Maybe it was the first draft that you'd done, or maybe it's the final one. I don't know.
No idea.
But he went off to go watch it. So that's just sort of why I thought. But we'll move on, shall we?
Very interesting. Let's.
Yeah. Scott Walker is someone who, before your amazing film, I saw that when it came out in the cinema. Before I'd seen that, all I knew was, I'm sure quite a lot of people did, was just the Walker Brothers, Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore, that kind of classic 60s crooner pop career that he'd had. Obviously, as you depict in that film, he then went on to just become one of the most pioneering, avant-garde, interesting songwriters that, you know, the world's ever seen. Mm-hmm. What an amazing man. How did that project start up, first of all? Just did it come from an interest
that was all
in his
me.
Music from you?
That was all me, yeah. I was obsessed. I had been turned on first to his 60s solo records. Before, I didn't know who the Walker Brothers were. I was living in San Francisco in the early 90s, and those solo records were just being issued on CD for the first time. And just some people I knew that I hung out with that were in bands were into a bunch of 60s psychedelic stuff, and they got their hands on them, and we were just hanging out one night. I think it was a very, very drunken Thanksgiving dinner at a friend's house. I remember lots and lots of red wine. Someone made a turkey, and then they slapped on like Scott Two, and everyone like started singing along, and the drunker they got, they all would like play it more, and it was like the Jacques Brel stuff, you know? I couldn't believe it. Like, what is this? It was so cool. Then I really got into Scott Four.
That was my first introduction to his solo stuff, and that's far out.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. It's actually not that far out. I mean, The Old Man's Back Again is just gorgeous stuff. The production is really great. You know, he wrote all that himself, and that was the one that tanked after he was a pop star, and you know, these were like number one, number three, top three type albums, and then the fourth one just failed to chart, and that started the decline. And then, you know, years later, I hear that there's this album Tilt out there in the world, that he's just made this new album that was like, what, 95, I think, and that was just such a departure. That's the beginning of the avant-garde phase. And I just loved it. So I just was obsessed with both these two polarities. Then discover the ones in the middle, you know, Climate of Hunter, very odd record, totally beautiful.
Which is the album where he's got like big oil drums on top of a piano or something, and he's moving them around in circular motions to get
the Drift. That's the album he was making when we made the film.
Right.
I heard he was about to make a new album. And when you see that he does maybe one a decade, you thought, my God, this could be it. What an amazing opportunity. And it had to be done.
It's an exceptional film as well. And I'd advise anyone who, even if they've never heard of Scott Walker, to check it out. Because it's a brilliant exploration of a great genius mind, isn't it?
Because he doesn't give you anything personally, and it was kind of the bargain you make with him, it had to be about his journey as an artist. Is about his creative world, his process, and I just find it fascinating. I love all the different twists and turns. I love the croony stuff. I like the noisy stuff. And to be let into the studio to see some of that stuff happening was really cool. Because once we decided to do it and we kind of got the permission to do it, you have to do it and follow it through all the way. And because it was a total passion project, you know, and he was so unknown and culty, it was all me. Like, we had to raise all the money ourselves. It was totally independent. Nobody wanted to help us. And eventually, you know, got a UK distributor behind it. And, you know, the rest is history. It came out great, did a lot of festivals, and I think was a good part of what helped kind of rehabilitate him. Because he's very busy now. In, you know, relative terms.
And was that the film which probably got your film career kickstarted and off the ground as well?
Well, it was
weird. Was it sort of already happening?
No. It took a little bit.
Because it was very critically well received.
It was very critically well received. I think what really kicked it was getting a call from the Rolling Stones, like out of nowhere.
That'll do it.
To do the film about Exile on Main Street. That really helped kick it up a notch.
That's the best Stones album as well, right?
It's the best Stones album. It was because it introduced me to John Batsek and Passion Pictures, who produced that. And now we've gone on to do, we're about to start our fourth film together. One of the best producers out there, and great creative team.
What do you look for as a filmmaker, as a director, in a good producer?
Well, they bring you great projects. So it started a kind of a trend of me not developing and pushing things uphill for 5 years at a time. It was just, here's a project, here's a subject, here's a budget, here's a schedule, go, which is a really rare place to be in. So I'm very fortunate in that respect. But it's a combination of a lot of things. It's just a great track record, great reputation, and it's creative and constructive, and they just give you the space to work. But they'll get in there and, you know, they'll get in there when they need to. He's very good in the edit room. He's one of the best kind of creative producers I've worked with. Just it's in terms of understanding how to like give directors and editors constructive criticism. Not all of them know how to do it. And I've worked with some that are not good at it. And you really can tell the difference. And it's like the track record. The guy's got two Oscars. He's given out, like, they must have produced over 50 plus feature documentaries, you know, partnerships all over the world. Great, great films, you know, great films, great subjects, a lot of respect. And we just enjoy working together. So
it counts for a lot.
Yeah. It's a good creative family to be in. It's not just him. It's the head of production, the woman I work with in LA, Diane Becker, who's produced the last few, who's, you know, works with John. It's like I'm in a good pocket with these people. We can just keep cranking them out. It almost doesn't matter what it's about, which is why when he brought me, he's like, how about a Japanese rock band? I'm like, sure, John, whatever you want.
So what was your, had you had any familiarity before this project began with the band?
None at all.
What a golden subject to be presented with.
I mean, sometimes it's timing and you're just like, geez, I really need to work. John, what can we do? You know, and we're always, because we enjoy working together, so we're always kind of trying to find stuff to do. And it just so happened that he had been contacted by Yoshiki's team. They wanted a film. They wanted the best producer to do it. And I do a lot of the music stuff, so he gave me a call and threw it at me. And, it was just weird timing, you know? It was just a quick, I mean, I've said it a million times, it was just literally a quick little Google, and you start to see images of them first, and you're hooked. I mean, you just look at the hair. The hair alone. Toshi has the highest mohawk of any human being ever. And then, you know, Yoshiki and just Hide, the whole bunch of them, they're so visually interesting. That you know there's going to be something under there that's really fascinating. You know, and I had seen my fair share of, you know, cosplay and the whole, you know, Harajuku thing. I mean, you see the visual sort of legacy everywhere, but you don't realize that, oh, wait, they're kind of there at the nexus of the start of all of it. So that was fascinating. Not necessarily pulled in by the music at first. I think I might have first heard a couple ballads, and I thought, ooh, not really for me. But then you keep digging, then you hit a song called Standing Sex, and it's just game over. It's like the greatest song I've ever heard. It was a deep well. A deep well to fall into.
From a narrative point of view, someone said on the way down here, I'm not going to name drop him, but he was like, you don't get two suicides and a singer being kidnapped by a cult in Coldplay.
You seriously do not.
I mean, from just the story.
No, I'm not going to say that.
From just the story point of view, I mean, where do you start as a storyteller with approaching those subjects? Were they open to just talk about it from the get-go?
Well, I mean, you know, to be fair, those are the story beats. I mean, you can't get away from it. Those are the events that have shaped the narrative of X Japan, you know? And to tell it, you have to lean into that. Why wouldn't you? You know what I mean? And Yoshiki knows it very well. I mean, it's as deep as pain, but it's also narratively his greatest strength, because he can build off of that adversary. He can build off of that adversity, and, you know, with his creativity, and use that as a real transformative pivot. You know what I mean? Like, his whole artistic project is kind of about death and rebirth over and over and over again. And that transfers to the fans. It's like this intense transference of that cycle that gives them all power. I've never seen anything like it. The depths of the tragedy, the heights of the creativity, and then that passion that ignites between band and fan base. I mean, I got tweets from somebody who saw the film, who went into the film having suicidal feelings and came out with a hope to live. You know what I mean? Like, the film X Japan, Yoshiki saved someone's life. You know, that's just one example. And it happens over and over and over again. So it's pretty intense. And yeah, I mean, where do you start? It's all there. I mean, you just have to start digging and asking questions about it. And the emotion just kind of, if you've seen the film, I mean, the waterworks just kind of come. This stuff's very much on the surface with him. So
that stuff about the cult, I mean, the suicidal elements to the story are obviously, you know, heartbreaking. But for me, what was almost the most, like, intriguing, I don't know whether that's the right word, but it's certain, I mean, you don't come across kidnappings by cults day to day in Western rock and roll bands, do you? You can't imagine, like, I mean, maybe someone like David Bowie would attract that level, and Prince and these people like that, but it's not really something that is, you know, commonplace in Western rock and roll. It's just not. I mean,
well,
because you don't explore it in that much detail in the film.
We don't. And it was partly, you know, it wasn't because we didn't want to. Toshi did tell us quite a bit about it. It just ends up becoming this thing where if you open the door a little bit wider, you're literally asking for a whole other movie about that. I mean, there's so much detail. We wanted to try to channel everything kind of through Yoshigi's perspective, and see how it affected him and the band, and how their journeys parallel, and then Toshi kind of goes away from him. So to dig too much into Toshi's narrative would have kind of made the film a bit lopsided, although it's so intriguing. Everyone wants to know more. Everybody wants to know more about the cult. I mean, he wrote a whole book about it, so it's not like it's some mystery. Toshi has a book published in Japan called, like, My 12 Years in Hell or something like that.
Exactly what it says on the tin.
Exactly.
Is that available in English? Do you know?
No. I mean, I have a little cheeky translation of it tucked away on my laptop somewhere.
The stuff that got me was the physical torture.
Yes. Just, I mean,
casually references, and I'm like, what?
You wonder if it's like a little mini Scientology or something. I don't know what goes on.
So it's Scientology as a joke in the room, but I didn't know if any of them perhaps were Scientologists.
I don't think so. it's tragic. I mean, it's your garden variety brainwash cult. I mean, it starts as, you know, self-help seminar, and it sounds like this, like, stuff like this in LA. I mean, like, again, Scientology, EST, which then became like the Forum. I mean, you hear things like this, where people will be brought in.
Well, I guess it's like what happens with actors like Tom Cruise and Will Smith with Hollywood.
Well, yeah,
on just a more extreme level.
Super extreme, yeah. I mean, they see an opportunity, but their methods were those of, you know, he was actually, and the thing is, it seemed like he was already in a vulnerable spot. His family was having problems. You know, fame screws people up in all sorts of different ways.
Yoshiki did kind of touch on that, and he said they were trying to make that record with the English language songs to go big in the US and the UK.
Yeah. So Toshi's confidence was constantly being eroded, but the fact that he couldn't step up to like the likes of, you know, Vince Neil or
Axl Rose,
you know, or all the great metal bands that they were probably seeing,
gods of their day, as
on the Sunset Strip while they were in LA hanging out. So he already feels like, you know, incapable of stepping up to that level. And lo and behold, this woman appears, kind of seduces him. They were in a play. It's very funny. He did a rock opera. He did a Japanese rock opera version of Hamlet. She was in the play. They marry, and she coaxes him into these self-help seminars run by this, it's called Home of the Heart was the name of the cult. And the guy that was the leader of the cult, no lie, his name was Masaya, M-A-S-A-Y-A, right? Not too suspect, right?
Evil emperor.
Yeah, they were just, you know, it was seminars. And before you know it, the tactics are, you know, he's being locked in a room, given a knife. They said it was like he was like put in a room with a mattress and a knife, told that that mattress is your family. You have to murder them to remove their influence from your life. Close the door, lock it. We'll see you when you're done. And like, who knows? Days could go by. You know what I mean? It was really bad. Stories of physical abuse. Beatings.
Did you talk to him directly much?
I did. We have a really long interview with Toshi. I mean, I read the whole book, and they brainwashed him, stole all his money. It was physical. It was mental. But it's not unique to him. I think this is just when you look across the history of cults and these kinds of organizations. This is what they do. And you have a wealthy rock star, you know, great opportunity to siphon him dry. And that's just what they did. And they reduced him to nothing. I mean, he was the leader of this cult, composed his own music, which was, you know, he
here's the beers.
Hey, finally.
How long did that take? Bloody hell. tip for them.
Now I'm going to start making some sense.
Cheers, Stephen.
Cheers. Basically Toshi was made to tour Japan playing this kind of like acoustic healing music. And you see a little clip of him in the film. He's got short hair, he's got a little sweater tied around his shoulders. He's just been reduced to this shadow of his former self. And all the proceeds, of course, go to the cult. And yeah, it's just shocking.
So the new record I've just heard is it finished? Because it's their first how long?
I don't know. I mean, it should be finished. It's supposed to be finished. It's supposed to have been finished a lot this last year, and it seems to keep moving further into the future. Part of the delay was because Yoshiki decided he wanted to write a new song for the movie to appear in the end credits, and he did. So everything stopped while he composed, recorded, and mixed, and remixed, and re-recorded La Venus, which is great. It's just, it's a really great, epic, ex-Japan rock ballad. It's beautiful. It suits the film real nice. I mean, there's not a huge amount of it in the film. It's a nice little taste. We've just been working on what I now understand will be one of two music videos for La Venus. Ours is going to be more the kind of animated film related version.
There's a lot of that in the film, and it's really quite a high level.
The animated stuff?
Yeah, did you have to sort of, you know, learn a whole new series of tricks?
No. No, actually, not at all. The company that the animators, the artists that do that stuff, the company's called Blue Spill. It's Allison Brownmore and Anthony Brownmore, who I've worked with now since the Stones movie, and they do a lot of films with Passion Pictures. They're extraordinary. We just got our groove on, and I have them do stuff on every film. And for this one, it was just super fun because, you know, look at the aesthetic you have to work with, right? I mean, I ordered up tons of old Visual K pop magazines from Japan, and
the sky's really the limit, isn't it?
The sky's the limit. And like all the Hide photo sessions he would do with Hideo Kano were nuts. And so like there was already this visual world that they created. Add to that the slogan of the band from the early days, which was psychedelic violence crimes of visual shock, which is how they described
that's amazing.
Their genre, their aesthetic niche. Project, right? And there was even stickers, and it's on the front of the Blue Blood album. That's kind of their slogan. So I said, look, that's your creative brief. Whatever that means to you, plus all of this visual stuff, that's what I want you to do.
Go have fun.
And they just went, okay, great. And that stuff just started coming. You know what I mean? It was really freeing. I generally know that whatever they kick back at me is going to be good. And that kind of freedom really energized them. And then the inspiration of all that raw material of the photos and the photo shoots that X already did. We took a lot of their existing stuff and just brought it to life. That was just fantastic. I mean, the opening credit sequence won an award at South by Southwest. It won the Audience Award for Excellence in Title Design. So super proud of that, because it's really the most badass opening credits you're ever going to see. It really is quite great.
It's like it could be a film in itself, couldn't it? It's a proper short. And then you've got some of the live footage. I mean, to go into, how many shows of theirs did you go to?
Oh, well, we only filmed...
Was it all stock footage? All of
Madison Square Garden.
It's only Madison.
Yeah, yeah. Like, he has an archive. Like, this is the other great thing about this film for us creatively, was that X Japan is very well documented. Yoshiki has been having the band and himself filmed for like...
Still now.
I mean, they could be right behind us. They don't know we're here, so... Yeah, no, it's... I mean, seriously, he asked me if I wanted to do the sequel, like, the other day. I said, you want to make another movie? He's got enough stuff, you know? It's great. There's, like, thousands and thousands of hours. Just, we literally could have made a 30-year-long movie, just stringing it all together. They've had every concert filmed with, like, 30 cameras. And they have all the rushes, every camera. It's all there. I've truly never seen anything like it. I mean, the Stones have a pretty great archive. But it's an extreme I've never experienced. And it was insane because you literally have this more footage you could ever possibly, absorb in one lifetime. But, we got a good way through it. But what was great is we could take individual concerts. Last Live being a great example, because you can look at the edited DVD, you know, which was probably cut in like what, early 2000s or something. There's an editorial style that doesn't suit our filmmaking, because it's quick cuts, it's dissolves, it's not very good. For storytelling, it's cut very quickly, but we could just find the one camera that was on Hide for 3 hours and isolate moments. You know, so we could pull it apart and find the Hide and the Toshi close-up and the Yoshiki,
filmmaker's
the
dream,
Yoshiki close-up, really. And then rebuild it for story, because there was a ton of drama going on at that concert, and you could just squeeze it right out of it and just zoom in on and find close-ups and just stay in them. It was so cool. It was really, really great.
Nice. And the X film, as a sort of final thought, What did you learn through the process of that film about that band that makes them a particularly unique proposition in the history of rock music? What makes them stand out from anyone else, aside from just the crazy stuff that's gone on
from the Mohawks? what is it, man? I don't know. It's not an easy question to answer. It's like learning about a person's creative journey. I mean, it's getting to know someone like Yoshiki has been an amazing experience. The first album I ever bought, the first album Toshi ever bought, the first album Yoshiki ever bought was Kiss Love Gun. You know, there's this weird common ground. It's the smallest thing, but it really made an impact on me. And it immediately kind of nudged us all kind of closer together. And I thought,
common ground.
I kind of get you now. Like something about that. He plays the drums. I play the drums. You know what I mean? There was like these funny little things. I just thought, you know, we're separated by cultures, language, you know, decades and just difference. And, you know, you've sold out the Tokyo Dome a million times. I'm, you know, just making rock documentary. I mean, there's just, but you kind of try to locate this sort of place that you can inhabit. It's where you kind of create empathy, right? And to graft people to him and his story is really important. Otherwise, they're not going to get into it. And it's not really about selling records. It's about understanding what makes, you know, a person tick or where their pain comes from, or, you know. But again, like I rambled on earlier, it's this incredible like thing that I've never seen with any other band. And it's just learned like the kind of the transformative power of music. Like it really, like, to say like music saved my life is something a lot of people say, and you can, you know, of course it did. it means a lot to all of us. But there's literally this messianic quality that I've observed with this band that is actually, it's very real. You know what I mean? You see it at the concerts. You experience it when you talk to the fans. It goes way beyond anything I've ever experienced. It's a little supernatural in a weird kind of way. And sometimes I give these answers and I think, am I just like, you know, am I just giving good interview, or is this like, no, this is, it actually, it's really tangible. It's really powerful. So it's a really long and convoluted answer to your question, but it's in there somewhere. The answer is in there somewhere.
Well, this podcast is all about life and, you know, journeys, emotional journeys, triumphs, struggles, not just product and content and Q&A. It's about discussion and exploration, and your film is that, and this chat has been that. And for me, I didn't have any... All I knew about the band going in to see the film was that they had a massive entourage at all times, and it was quite a bizarre circus operation. That's all I knew. And after watching it, I was like, wow, it's one of the most human, relatable, as removed as it is from my experiences, because, you know, two suicide, well, three, his dad, his two bandmates, a cult. I mean, that's so far
removed
from
anything.
There are
more bodies, too. We didn't put them all in. It just would have been too depressing.
Right.
Not all suicides, just bizarre deaths. I mean,
it's a distant, removed story, but at the same time, it's rooted in basic human struggle and triumph over adversity and creativity.
And it rocks hard, man. They still rock really hard. You're going to go to the show? Have you seen
it? It's next Saturday, isn't it? I'm going to go. Wembley Arena next Saturday. Putting me on, Ben. Putting me on that guest list. Am I your date? Yeah, I'm well up for that. You're going to be there. You stick around for it, or
I'm supposed to go. I'm here in London. I'm here all the way through. So,
all right. Well, let's have a beer at the show then. Yeah,
absolutely.
Let's hang out then.
Absolutely.
Thanks for your time,
yes,
mate.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, Matt. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Have a seat.
Thank you.
Do you need water or anything?
I'm okay.
You okay?
Yeah.
Matt, I'll leave you guys to
Thanks, buddy. All right, cool. If we can, I just want to try and position this close to your mouth as possible so I can pick up. Maybe if you could lean in a little bit to around where I am, would be great. It's a real honor to meet you.
Pleasure.
I was vaguely familiar with the band through a mutual friend, Wes Borland. I have interviewed several times over
Wes
the years.
Borland?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And he told me about going out. Was it three shows that he did when you did the special shows? Was it three in total?
Reunion shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, he played three nights, yeah.
He said it was one of the most surreal and overpowering experiences of his career.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much we have to cover in such a short space of time. I wonder if, first of all, you could tell me, there's a moment in the film when, I can't remember whether it's yourself or someone else, he's talking about, in the history of Japanese culture, there was almost pre-ex-Japan and post. I wonder if you could sort of put me in the picture and tell me a bit about what Japan and maybe youth culture was like before your band and before that whole explosion and cultural revolution.
Okay. Well, let's see. If you go to Tokyo right now, you may see a bunch of people with pink hair, purple hair, red hair, or blonde hair. So when we started doing this kind of thing, there's no people like that. If you have blonde hair like this, probably cannot get stop cab at all.
It was that level of almost social complete outcastness.
Yeah, very conservative.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, yeah. It's pretty much, it's not known or anything, but nobody was like, you know. Okay, put it this way. When I was at junior high, I dyed my hair red. They went to school after summer break or something. Then my teacher grabbed me, then shaved my head.
In the class, right then and there?
Yes.
Wow.
I mean, it should be, super big deal if you do that. It's maybe some like when the parents can sue the teacher or whatever, but.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And what did the rest of the class do? What was their reaction?
Oh, I don't know.
If that was today, they'd be streaming it Facebook Live, wouldn't they?
Exactly. It's going to be a big problem around the world.
That's
phenomenal.
What was your introduction then to alternative culture, to rock and roll? Where did it come from? Did it come from American bands? Did it come from, say, MTV? What was your introduction? How did you discover rock and roll music if it wasn't, you know, accepted in Japan at the time?
I was only listening to, playing classical music. Know to my father passed away, so I saw my father used to buy me a vinyl, like classical albums, like every month. So he passed away, so I started going to the record shop. I just one day I just passed. I saw a Kiss album cover. It was a single called Love Gun or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is this? So that was the first time I bumped into rock. Yeah,
that's quite an introduction, because they are, and definitely were then, the loudest, weren't they? The most flamboyant, the most over the top.
Then I found out they are coming to Japan. I saw some kind of newspaper. There's like Kiss coming to Japan. Like, whoa. So I asked my mother to take me to the concert.
So she took you?
Yeah.
So was your mother perhaps more liberal than, say, some of her age group and generation?
Not really, because she was wearing kimono.
Right.
As traditional as you can get. You know?
Right, right.
But
did she just want to support you?
Because my father took his own life.
Mm-hmm.
So she somehow felt guilty towards us. I mean, us means me and my brother. Because she said the person I chose, which was my father, took his own life. So she kind of tried to, you know, compensate or something. So I asked anything, buy me drum set. She bought me drum set, took me to Kiss concert. She took me to Kiss concert. Yeah.
It was obviously a huge and, you know, extremely painful thing to go through at such a young age. I was amazed at how, and really blown away by how honest this new documentary film is, and how heartbreaking really it is. What it really gets to the core of, I think, is what makes your band special, and what so many people, not just in Japan but all over the world, connect with, is this idea of, as I think you say actually in the film itself, about having scars and learning to live with those scars, and still making sure that life is a celebration, even though sometimes it can be extremely difficult.
Right. I mean, you know, you can't really change your past, but it depends on how you live for the future.
Mm-hmm.
The past can shine, or past can be really dark. You know, so you can somehow change the image of the past. Depends on how you live your lives for the future. Yeah. So.
Was music your salvation?
Completely. If I was not doing music, or if music was not next to me, I don't think I survived.
Mm. And I think so many people who either play music or consume it and, you know, eat up and listen to as much of it as they can get their hands on, I think so many, it's such a universal, powerful art form, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
That really goes beyond, I mean, I'm an appreciator of all art, as I'm sure you are, but there's something so unique and powerful and special about music.
I mean, the cool thing about...
What is it for music? What is it about music for you that makes it so special and powerful?
Because music can combine with any form of the other arts. You know, music with the film, music with the paint, music with everything. I think, like, the music I create was also soundtrack of my life, you know. Then it's like, it's sometimes it's how to create the music, how to compose. I don't know. I never, like, you know, had baby, or I'm a male. I cannot really, you know,
you can't give birth. Yeah,
but almost I'm feeling like giving a birth,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Like the songs of your children.
Songs, exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So those songs, a lot of times, helped me, like when I'm going through a hard time. Yeah, it sounds strange.
I heard, I can't remember who told me this quote, but they said that songs are never finished, ever. You just get to a point where you have to let them out. It's almost like a child has grown up and you have to let them go out into the world. Do you feel like that, or do you feel like once you've released a song, it is finished? How do you feel about that?
It's so hard to let it go, you know. So that's why probably I have not released an album past 20 years, 21 years or so. We are about to release a new album, finally.
Mm-hmm.
But so I'm having the final thoughts about should I let it go or not.
And I guess the longer time goes, the more perhaps anxious you get about putting out something new, right? Would you agree with that?
That too. Yeah.
So how are you feeling about I mean, your fans assumedly are excited to the point of breaking after, you know, so many years. And I think that part of the pressure obviously comes with expectation from your fan base as well, because you don't want to let them down.
At the same time, you know, this kind of time, like, people can listen to, can get the opinion from fans a lot, like any artist, right? So I want you to create this kind of song, you went to in this kind of art. It is great to hear what fans think, but at the same time, you have to, as an artist, yeah, sometimes you have to ignore entirely. Just, I'm going to create, no matter what people say, I'm going to create this kind of art.
Just to be true to yourself,
yes.
Right?
Yes. So some of the songs fans may like, some of the songs fans may hate. But this is what I'm creating right now. Yeah. So it's some kind of danger about social media, about when it comes to the creation of art.
Everyone has a voice, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So sometimes you have to ignore them all.
Mm-hmm. Don't look at the comments. That's what you got to do. Could I ask you about your singer?
Okay.
And what happened there? Because it's touched upon in the film, and I mean, I've heard and read about that sort of thing happening before. There was an artist, I'm sure you know, Peter Green, who had a similar sort of thing where, you know, a cult kind of like kidnapped him and took him away. I mean, just as much or as little detail as you want to go into, but I'd be really interested to know your perspective on what happened with him leaving the band. And, you know, it was such a long period of time that he was away from, and assumedly during that whole time your friendship was...
I think that the... Okay, so my vocalist joined cult group. So that's the reason Nick Chapman broke up. Then, you know, 10 years later, we got reunited. I think that's... I kind of blamed myself too. It's like, it's my fault. It's not, I don't know, it's entirely, but I mean, vocals and grew up together when we met each other when we were 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So then everything was fine. We became the biggest band in Japan, but we started aiming the market overseas. We wanted to, actually went to America and started recording. So I was so ambitious about releasing our English album. So I was really harsh on his pronunciation because I was also a producer. I'm also a producer too. So when I'm producing his vocal tracking, just kept doing again and again and again. So I didn't really think about how he was feeling. So I think I almost used his voice as a tool. Like, so then, you know, I can say that right now. But at that time, I just didn't even think. So... then I think he was just really having a hard time dealing with the band, dealing with me. Yeah.
Was he perhaps feeling like he wasn't meeting your expectation then, do you think?
That's what he said. I also made him look like he was not meeting, you know, my expectation. I was really harsh. Yeah.
And, I mean, the cult itself, did you ever sort of get to the bottom of what they were about, what they wanted?
As I was not in the cult, so I don't know 100%. But as far as I heard from Toshi, it's not really, really cult. It's that they're using that kind of like format. And then, well, even I think it's worse. It's more like a business. More like they recruited Toshi to make money. So he, you know, after... actually, that's another reason Toshi came back. So cult leader eventually told Toshi to join, create X Japan again, so he can contribute
so
more
money. So he can make a little bit.
Yeah. When Toshi came back, like after almost 8-9 years, X Japan's broke up, I kind of knew something not right. But I thought that was also, I saw the hope. Get reunited, I may be able to bring him back from that world. So it may take time, but so I was like, let's get reunited, you know, then. So eventually he came back. Yeah, he realized. Yeah.
It's a wild chapter in your career, isn't it?
Completely.
A really wild chapter.
Yeah.
Were you totally estranged during that whole period, that break, as friends? Was there any communication, or was he fully in it? And
pretty much zero.
Right.
Only thing I heard was, it was on Japanese TV, news TV, the rock star was brainwashed. Toshi was on TV. He was saying, I was not brainwashed. I was not brainwashed. You guys are weird. There's some kind of like a argument between, kind of fight between his group and then media. I was living in Los Angeles. I didn't see that much Japanese TV, but I went back to Japan sometime, once in a while. Then I saw the news. I was like, whoa, what's going on? But I didn't want to actually touch the subject. I was pretty much done that kind of like ex-Japan or ex-lives. So because, you know, the guitar player Hide passed away, you know, five months after our breakup, ex-Japan's breakup. So I didn't want to touch that subject. So almost 10 years, I had zero idea about what's going on, Toshi.
What do you remember from the day? Was it Los Angeles, you said, when you were reacquainted? What do you remember from that day when you reconnected with him for the first time in almost a decade?
It's really strange. There's a guitar player called Toshi. He's just the same name, Japanese guy. He was playing with the David Lee Roth band, like Van Halen's vocalist, band.
Yeah.
So he was actually doing some session with me once in a while in Los Angeles. Then somebody, said, Toshi's on the phone. Call my studio, recording studio. Okay, I thought that Toshi was that Toshi. Then when I pick up the phone, I was like, whoa, ex-Japan Toshi. I was like, what's going on?
I didn't expect to hear from you today, yeah.
Not at all.
And what did he say? I'm coming out and I want to see you. And
well, he said, how are you? You know, I said, like, I guess I'm okay, and how are you? You know, so he said, yeah, then she said, can I come to Los Angeles to see? Yeah. I knew something was going on. Yeah. Then when I saw his face, he was still not the person I knew. So really different.
Is he now?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the brainwashing process, as far as I know, because after Toshi came back, I started learning about what exactly is brainwashing. I don't think it's going to wake up like one day, like even, gradually, yeah, waking up, yeah.
It's unbelievable. Tell me about your physicality and the experience for you of, because there's some really powerful scenes in the film when, I guess you're reaching the climax in the set and you're giving it every single ounce of, your being into the performance, and then at the end you obviously there's a couple of scenes when you collapse on the floor because you've just got nothing left to even prop yourself up. What are you experiencing and going through in your head during those moments of sheer, and what would the term be? Would it be sort of ecstasy? Would it be?
I was very, maybe still a little bit, suicidal.
Right.
Because after my father passed away, after my father took his own life, I didn't want to be in this world. So I was kind of looking for the reason to die or kill myself, something like this. Then at the same time, beating the drum really hard, is kind of like release that kind of anger, that kind of feeling. So I started banging drums really hard. Sometimes like almost too hard to try to almost like break my body or something like this. That kind of pain kind of offsets the pain inside. So try to create the physical pain to offset the mental pain.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Because some people, I think, try and numb it with perhaps drink or alcohol.
Or some people even cut themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yours was just, I guess, transmitting it into another form, something productive, creative. And
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell me about Marilyn Manson. How did you two meet?
It's a very strange.
I bet it is.
I also do a bunch of fashion things. I have my own fashion brand, Kimono. Anyway, I was organizing fashion show several years ago. Then at that time, my partner, we are choosing a bunch of interesting models. Then inviting some actresses or some more around the world. That's pretty big fashion show, actually, like audience of 10,000 people like that, with also extra bands performing, the several bands performing like that. Then my partner said, why don't you, why can't we have Marilyn Manson as a fashion model? Really? That's a very good, interesting idea. So I knew his manager, and then I met him before, so Manson. So I asked him, do you want to come to Tokyo, do the as a runway as fashion model? he liked it. So he came, then, you know, they became very close. Then, yeah.
He seems like one of the most switched on, smart, intelligent, interesting characters in all music, not just in heavy music, but in all music.
He's very smart. He's very, how do you say, he's a very fashionable person in that, you know, even though he can do super heavy music too, but yeah.
That's amazing. And Gene Simmons is in the documentary. Is he someone that you have a relationship with? Because obviously, you've just told me that Kiss were the band that turned you on to rock and roll music.
Yeah, so Kiss is always my, you know, hero. Then, how many years ago was that? Long time ago, they made an album called, Kiss tribute album called Kiss My Ass. So then, you know, I think Gene was producing his the tribute album, Kiss tribute album. There are a bunch of amazing artists like Lenny Kravitz, and anyway, so he asked me if I wanna be, you know, joining that one tribute album. So as a classical composer, kinda. So I made the their song, a song called Black Diamond, into piano concerto.
Wow!
So I arranged the orchestration. Also, I played piano as well. So since then, you know, we became a good friend.
Talking of piano music and classical music, that was obviously where your, I guess, whole musical story began as a young child. There's a moment in the film which is, again, really inspiring, when you talked about basically being at a point where you were ready to give up music and walk away from it forever. But then you're invited or hired by the Emperor of Japan to compose. What was the occasion?
His 10 years anniversary of his reign.
Right.
Yeah, so.
And that was what reinvigorated your whole love affair with music, right?
Yes. So I composed piano concerto. So.
Tell me about that. Tell me about where you wanted to come from emotionally and what you wanted to, I guess, express in the music that you made.
So I made a one theme melody. But actually that was perfect timing because I was really lost. So the same melody could be a major or minor movement. So I wanted to describe kind of people, because emperors are such an amazing symbol in Japan. So I want to describe 10 years of Japanese history, or Japanese people, what Japan went through. So I created a pretty dramatic piano concerto. Also, at that time, I was like, I was about to give up music, because whenever I thought about music, that led me to the sad memories of my member's death, brainwashing event, situation, as well as, you know, my father's death. So, but it's so, strange, amazing to just like, probably I turned down every single offer, but coming from that kind of, you know, Emperor is such an amazing figure in Japan. So I really respect that. So almost, you know, I asked my mother, what should I do? But I almost didn't have a choice. But that brought me back to that stage.
there's so few people as well that could straddle both worlds so seamlessly. And that's obviously a testament to your vision and your talent. But I mean, I can't imagine Gene Simmons ever writing an opera. Do you know what I mean? There's very few people that can exist in those two drastically different worlds. And I only saw a snippet of the song that you composed in the film, but was blown away by it, the power of it. And so different, so radically different to X-Japan. But then I guess X-Japan is such a varied beast, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's so much going on.
Right.
I just want to say as well, I'm really inspired by your whole story. And, you know, the things that you've been through, just unbelievable sadness. And to have come through it all and to just still be here and, you know, about to play Wembley, which isn't exactly a local pub gig. It's, you know, I mean, how are you feeling about that show? Well, congratulations, first of all, just on an amazing, like, strength of will and a great career. But, yeah, Wembley, tell me about the excitement in the X camp leading up to this show, because this must be a pretty big event for you, right?
Yeah, so last time X Japan performed here in London, we played at a place called Shepherd Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was an amazing show. We love the audience. So this time, yes, a little bigger. But compared to the place, you know, X Japan performed in Tokyo before, because it's Wembley Arena, so it's not a stadium. So
it's a club show for you guys.
It's not, I wouldn't say that, but it was just, you know, I mean, I'm glad we can bring the little bigger production to, you know, overseas. So pretty much the second time, because we also did a North American tour before, but that was like a couple thousand people. But we did Madison Square Garden. That time we brought the big, you know, our kind of like a, you know, big stage. So this time it's kind of same vibe. So I'm very glad we can be doing this, you know, bunch of pyros and yeah. So
amazing. Just as a final thought, what's your time in this band taught you about life? What are the main lessons that you've picked up and learned along the way? Because it's obviously been quite an exceptional journey.
I'd say do not take anything for granted. What you have right this moment could be your friend, could be your family. Anything you have could be just a miracle. We just don't realize how lucky you are till you lose that person or what you have. So everything seems like just normal, but I think you guys are so lucky to have what you have right this moment. That's the... So, you know, I mean, we are living in the same era right now, so, you know, everything's just a miracle. So I don't take anything for granted anymore.
Amen. A real pleasure to meet you. Thank you. Thank you for your time. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Another day has gone. Another friend has gone. Into the flame. It's burning up. 自分 で切り裂いた 胸の傷跡さえ
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.